Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and welcome to a non-profit, non-commercial, non-fattening community radio station. Today's program includes David Dionysia and the Teach Peace Foundation, and includes an interview of David Dionysia from KXJZ's Jeffrey Callison. Includes Chris Hedges. The first part is from October 15, 2007. David Dionysia, who is a former military intelligence officer, corporate officer, and international volunteer. He is also the author of a book on U.S. foreign policy, America Hiroshima, and the founder of the Teach Peace Foundation. In this interview, which was broadcast on cable television in the San Francisco Bay Area, Mel Van Dusen asks David Dionysia about his perspectives on 9/11, his work on strengthening American democracy. Among other interesting points, David Dionysia makes the case that reckless spending on the war on terror, limitations of our civil rights, and imperialism abroad actually works against the effort to make us safer in our communities. This interview is about 29 minutes.
Well, I've put aside my notes. I don't have any more questions, but you have a lot more to say. So where do you see us going? You've written this book. Your life has been changed by your work. What final comments do you have for us?
Well, I think people should know that every action counts. Whether it's a moment of silent prayer, whether it's a person who is writing a letter to the editor, or as you said earlier, contacting a member of Congress, it all counts. Now, some things count more than others. And right now, we would love to have more people help us get our program into more high schools, because that, for us, is such an opportunity to impact people in a major way. And that can be as simple as someone has a child in high school, they contact their local high school and say they would like to have this program, and they set up a meeting. We'll do everything. All they have to do is get the meeting for us to go in and present our case, and very often the schools are so impressed by us that they'll assign a faculty advisor and connect us with a student, and the next thing you know, we've got another high school under our belt.
Great.
So that's one powerful thing. There's so many things that can be done, and I encourage anyone that needs help on getting connected in the peace movement to contact us at the Teach Peace Foundation. We have full-time resources to help you, and the phone number is 530-554-7061.
Okay, David, I think we're out of time. And you're an inspiration and a true American patriot. So thank you so much for being on the show.
And now, from August 3rd, 2005, KXJZ's Jeffrey Callison interviews David Dionysia about nuclear threats on our own soil. It's about 9 minutes long.
The recently published book, American Hiroshima, discusses nuclear and other terrible threats facing the United States today. It was written by David Dionysia, a former Army intelligence officer and business executive. He lives in Davis and joins us in our studio. David Dionysia, welcome to Inside.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why is your book called American Hiroshima?
Well, the next 9/11 attack is actually called American Hiroshima. Few people realize that Osama bin Laden had first conceived of the 9/11 attack back in 1982 when he saw tall office buildings in Lebanon being destroyed. And because he had planned American Hiroshima before 9/11, it helps put in context a lot of things that didn't happen on 9/11. For instance, nuclear power facilities were not hit by any of the aircraft, and that's because Osama bin Laden had specifically instructed his leadership to leave nuclear power plants alone so that they would be left unprotected for the next attack.
Are you saying that Osama bin Laden was referring to this future attack as the American Hiroshima?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, this tends to be one of the harder parts for people to believe when they first see the book, but Senator Sam Nunn just came out with a video in cooperation with the Nuclear Threat Institute, and it's called The Last Best Chance. He, as well as both the chairs of the 9/11 Commission, now have a video that it communicates that the American Hiroshima attack is a very real threat, and that adds a lot of credibility to the book. It's available free for anyone that would like it. They just need to go to my website, which is www.americanhiroshima.info. That's .info, and there's no shipping charges. It'll be sent to them for free.
How do you know Osama bin Laden used that expression?
Well, it's been said several times. If you look at Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the chief planner of 9/11, he gave an interview on Al Jazeera just before he was captured by the CIA. And in that interview, he was asked specifically why the nuclear power stations in the United States were not hit on 9/11, because obviously that would have done far more damage than crashing the airplanes into buildings. And he talked about how the entire leadership was passionate about hitting a nuclear facility, and that Osama bin Laden wanted them left alone so that this American Hiroshima attack would be more successful in the future. Also, the official spokesperson for Osama bin Laden has gone on record saying this and saying the goal is to kill 4 million Americans.
So if Osama bin Laden or other affiliated terrorists and terrorist groups were to launch a nuclear attack in the United States, are you saying it would most likely be by blowing up or crashing a plane into a nuclear plant?
No, actually, what they're going to do is try to repeat the formula that played very well for them on 9/11. You know, throughout the Islamic world, when the story is told of a few men with box cutters hijacking a commercial asset like an airplane and turning it into a guided missile, that's seen as very innovative and ingenious. And so what Osama bin Laden wants to do is he wants to detonate a bomb at a nuclear power facility. And what happens is we have 103 nuclear power facilities in the United States, and the spent fuel is kept on site in unarmored or unprotected ponds. If you explode a bomb at one of those targets, you create a disaster that's far worse than Chernobyl.
How realistic a threat is this? Because I'm sure that Osama bin Laden and other terrorists love to pontificate about the kinds of things they'd like to do. But it's one thing to talk about what you think would be a good thing to do, and another thing to do it, especially on such an enormous and horrific scale as what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely good point. One thing I can share with you is the gentleman that used to run the Find Osama team in the CIA, his name is Michael Schur. He said one thing about Osama bin Laden to always take seriously is if he says something, know that he is serious about executing it. It may take him 10 years. It may take him some period of time that's beyond what we would normally expect. But he is passionate about doing that. And his track record has proven that to be true.
Mm. My guest is David Dionisi, author of American Hiroshima. If you go to our website, there's a link to his website if you want more information. David, you're a former military intelligence officer. What does that mean?
I used to work on both the collection and analysis team. And most recently, though, I've been working internationally as a volunteer. I run an orphanage in Liberia, West Africa.
I see. Have you had any contact either through your work as a volunteer or in the military with terrorists or terrorist activity?
Well, it's hard to work in Africa and not come across people that are Islamic or potentially even Islamic fundamentalists. But I wouldn't say terrorists in the sense that, you know, we would define terrorists. I think there are a lot of people, especially in Africa, that think very highly of the United States and hope that our foreign policies change. I make the case in the book that the war in Iraq has really hurt us more than it has helped us. Because prior to the invasion of Iraq, Osama bin Laden, he communicated to the Islamic world that the United States was going to occupy Iraq not only for its oil, but to control the largest freshwater supply in the Middle East. The Tigris and the Euphrates are by far the largest freshwater supply, and water is the resource and the scarcest supply in the Middle East, not oil. With a population in the Middle East at about 280 million people and growing at a very fast rate, matter of fact, it will double much faster than the population here in the United States. Mm-hmm. The country that controls the water is really able to control the people. And that's why if you look at the permanent bases that are being built in Iraq right now, we have 14 that are under construction. They're all along the waterways and not necessarily by the oil fields.
Well, should the United States pull out of Iraq then?
I would say absolutely, because
now?
If you look at, and I'll give you a solution that hasn't been debated. There are a number of countries in Africa that are Muslim countries that, as part of a UN effort, would be very happy to go in and act as peacekeepers. And I argue that a peacekeeping force that's primarily composed of Muslim and African Muslims is more likely to restore order and peace and prosperity in Iraq than a U.S. or Christian-backed army ever could.
What do you think the main focus of the United States should be in protecting itself against terrorism? Should it be a military approach, in other words, going into Afghanistan, for example, or Iraq or some other place to try and find terrorists where they are? Or is it more of a law enforcement activity in the United States with police and the FBI trying to find people who are already in the country?
Well, first and foremost, I think we need to acknowledge a new paradigm, and that is nuclear weapons do more to empower the weak than protect the strong. When you realize that, you understand the solution to preventing nuclear terrorism is promoting justice around the world. We're in a very unique position, in part due to our resources, part due to our history, to help promote a more peaceful world. And I advocate a new way of thinking. I argue that by promoting justice and helping solve the problems in terms of hunger and access to clean water and access to education around the world, we'll do far more to defeat terrorism than we ever will through military or intelligence investments.
Hmm. Do you think that's likely to happen?
Not with the current administration, but I'm optimistic that the American people have been able to overcome tremendous adversity in the past, and it's a matter of educating people that an American Hiroshima attack is the guaranteed outcome of our current foreign policy. If we promote this new way of thinking, where we are helping to restore justice around the world, we stop supporting corrupt dictators in the Middle East, and we hold true to the values that we value at home as part of our foreign policy, then it would actually backfire if Osama bin Laden tried to have an American Hiroshima attack. Because at the end of the day, he not only wants to hurt America for basically the justice of hurting Muslims, he wants to grow his movement. And if we are shutting down his pipeline by pursuing foreign policies that promote justice, and he then attacks us, he would actually potentially be able he for hundreds of years potentially shut down his ability to recruit and grow his movement.
Mm. Finally, we're almost out of time. How should the average American feel right now about the likelihood of a terrorist attack?
They should feel that it's on the horizon because our current foreign policy is making things worse, not better. They should ask themselves questions: why? Why wasn't a plane flown into a nuclear power facility on September 11th? Why haven't there been any attacks since 9/11? And they should start to realize that the information's out there. If they read books like American Hiroshima, they'll see solutions that are not popular for this administration. Because if I'm advocating, you know, seriously protect all of our nuclear facilities, that kind of flies in the face of the Bush administration that wants to build new nuclear facilities at this point in time.
Mm. David Dionisi, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's David Dionisi, author of American Hiroshima.
On December 2nd, 2008, Scott Horton interviewed Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges discusses the anti-occupation motives of terrorists, the similarities of extremists that transcend religion and culture, and how a U.S. economic collapse could usher in a popular uprising of the Christian right. This is about 36 minutes long.
So welcome back to Anti-War Radio. Our next guest is Chris Hedges. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He's covered wars all over the world for the New York Times, the Dallas Morning News, the Christian Science Monitor, National Public Radio. He's a lecturer at Princeton University, currently writes for Truth Dig. He's the author of American Fascist, the Christian Right, and the War on America. War is a force that gives us meaning, which, if you take my word for it, goes at the very top of your list for next book that you read. Also, what every person should know about war and losing Moses on the freeway. Welcome back to the show, Chris. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good.
Very good to have you on the show here. Glad to know you're doing all right. This is a great article that you have at Truth Dig here, one that I wish everyone would read. It's called Confronting the Terrorist Within. And basically what you're doing here is you're holding what I guess in this society amounts to a funhouse mirror up to the American people in order to show them the truth from that other point of view, a truth that seems so hard to grasp. And I guess I try to remember, you know, when I was younger and just couldn't get my head around the idea that it mattered that foreigners being bombed as compared to Americans. You know, I guess I was in ninth grade during the first Gulf War, and the attitude, you know, around my neighborhood was, you know, nuke them all till they glow, and who cares about them, and that kind of thing. It seems like a pretty easy stance to take, you know, our team versus their team, and they're just not very human, and we're good, and they're evil, and so somehow all the evil things that we do to them become okay. Chris, that's basically how it works, isn't it?
Well, you know, having spent 20 years abroad on the receiving end of American power, you begin to look at not only the world, but what we do in the world very differently. And I think, you know, we have to be really upfront with the fact that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, when matched against every ethical and legal code whether it's just war theory, whether it's the statutes of international law set down in the post-Nuremberg laws after World War II, define the invasion and occupation of nations that do not pose a threat to you as criminal wars of aggression. That's what they are. These conflicts, especially in Iraq, have left hundreds of thousands of people dead, people who did not pose a threat to us. Millions of people have been driven from their home, and we have no moral or legal right to debate the terms of the occupation. That's just from a start. But when you, as I have spent time in villages that have been hit by American ordnance, 500,000-pound fragmentation bombs, you understand how an Afghan villager that's burying members of his own family killed in an American airstrike understands in a way that I think we as Americans do not, that terrorist attacks can also be unleashed from the arsenals of the American Air Force, from an imperial power.
Yeah, and that really is the thing, right? Terrorism means acts of organized aggression by people who don't have a state anywhere to control, but would like one someday or something. But anything that a state does that is in the name of a response to that becomes somehow just blessed and legitimate because they're all terrorists after all.
Yeah, and I think we have to understand the relationship between what we do around the globe and the response of people who define themselves as, you know, fighting against the reach of American imperialism. I quote in the article from Robert Pape's book, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, where he studied suicide bombings and attacks from around the world. And, you know, it's a great study because it rips apart all of the mythologies that we use to demonize terrorists. You know, he found that in almost every case, suicide bombers arise from communities that have deep feelings of collective humiliation by genuine or certainly perceived occupation. He writes that every major suicide terrorist campaign, that's over 95% of them, are carried out to drive out an occupying power, and that would be true in Mumbai as well, with most of the, as far as we can tell, most of these terrorists or militants were come out of Kashmir, where the Indian Army has used draconian and ruthless methods to crush a Muslim insurgency.
And in fact, it fits the rest of the criteria too, in the sense that they're of a different religion, which is very important for people not just fearing their death, but fearing that their children will, their lives and their entire society will be changed if they lose. And at the same time, India at least is somewhat a democracy, and so pressure from below on their government by the people to come to a solution is actually possible. As opposed to, I think he says terrorism doesn't work very well in China because the Politburo doesn't care if you bomb a bunch of people.
Right.
It's not going to affect them.
Well, you need access to a media. I mean, you know, that's one of the things you learn. And when you live in a totalitarian state like China, they can just shut the national media down. I mean, they can just make a terrorist attack virtually invisible, which we know they largely did in attacks that were carried out before and even during the Olympics.
Right. I didn't know that, even during the Olympics, huh?
Well, there were a series of shootings, and there were a series of minor incidents, which the Chinese authorities pretty effectively covered up.
You know, I'm sure you remember in the presidential campaign, Robert Pape's book, Dying to Win, was brought up by Ron Paul in his argument that it was American occupation and intervention in the Middle East that caused September 11th, that history didn't begin that day, but that was a reaction to things that America had done before. And, of course, that caused the giant controversy because Rudy Giuliani, who I'm not sure if you heard, was actually there that day, he, of course, accused Ron Paul blaming America for the attack and saying that we deserved it or something like that. But he was simply observing the laws of physics, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, with the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990, we sent over tens of thousands of troops. We had very little, by the way, military presence before 1990 in the Middle East. We sent over tens of thousands of troops to the Middle East, which have not left. And it's the presence of these troops, along with, of course, the continued abuse of Palestinians by Israel, that has been the most potent recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda. You know, Pape points out correctly that, this idea that, you know, there is sort of a supply-limited number of a few crazy psychopathic religious fanatics coming out of madrasas who want to reap maximum terror on the West is just wrong. That this is a demand-driven phenomena. That is, that it's driven by the presence of foreign forces on Muslim soil that is viewed by many Muslims, and correctly so, as a form of occupation. And that the invasion and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, and statistically this is borne out, has increased and augmented the ranks of suicide terrorists, and given these radical groups, you know, a kind of new lease on life.
And, you know, I think it is really important. You mentioned how they're middle class, the profile of the suicide terrorists, at least the lead hijackers. I don't know about the muscle guys, but the lead hijackers in the September 11th case, I know Muhammad Atta, for example, was a graduate student in engineering. They were all upper middle class, university educated guys from mostly from Cairo. And
most of them were from Saudi Arabia, 14 of them from Saudi Arabia.
I mean the actual pilots of the planes, the crew. I mean, the Saudi muscle was kind of brought in at the end, you know, sort of thing. But anyway, they were, and I guess even the Saudis who were brought in toward the end also were sort of, you know, middle-class types, which is in stark contrast to what, you know, mainstream media tends to depict,
right,
and what the Bush administration depicts as poor, helpless people who need to be invaded and given democracy so that they won't be poor and helpless anymore, and then they'll love us and not want to be terrorists anymore.
Well, I mean, when we look at the profiles, and, you know, I did this for a year for the New York Times, reconstructing where terrorists came from, Al-Qaeda terrorists came from, in various attacks, either those carried out or aborted throughout Europe and North Africa. And that's true. Most of them came from the middle class. And in some cases, very privileged positions relatively to the, certainly the impoverished lives of most of their, most of the Tunisians or Algerians or wherever it was that they came from. And, so it wasn't that they experienced direct personal affronts to their dignity necessarily. It was more often that they were fired up by abstract ideals, national, ethnic, religious, you know, purging the world of evil in a kind of bizarre, twisted way. That's precisely what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to purify the world through force, which is always self-defeating. We're trying to insist that we can use violence to mold the world into our vision of what it should be, which is precisely what they're doing. And the more, you know, these kinds of utopian visions backed by violence feed off of each other. So the more the violence is ratcheted upward, the more we are uncertain and afraid, the more reality impinges on this fantastic notion of a harmonious world, the more strident, absolutist, and aggressive we become. I think that when you understand the psychology of those who carry out these kinds of attacks and match it to our own, you find disturbing parallels.
Mm-hmm. We keep doing what doesn't work until it destroys us all. Yes. And you know, I like the way you point out in the article in order to do the putting yourself in the other guy's shoes point of view, you talk about in the humiliation. That was really, you know, what happened on September 11. That's why the American people were willing to support not just an invasion of Afghanistan, but of Iraq, too, because Afghanistan just wasn't enough. There weren't enough things to bomb there. We got to bomb some more people. And, I mean, basically, it's the same difference. If you're an Arab, when America commits September 11th type attacks against you all the time, it makes you just about the same amount of angry. There's no reason why it shouldn't.
Yeah, I think that you know, for us, we had feelings of vulnerability as a nation, which were new, feelings of collective humiliation, and that we, by invading Iraq and Afghanistan, attempted to exercise through reciprocal violence what we felt had been done to us. And this is exactly the driving force behind groups like Al-Qaeda. If you look closely at, the statements and writings, for instance, of Osama bin Laden, he talks all the time about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And this was the agreement that led to the carving up of the Ottoman Empire and the real beginning of Arab humiliation. He constantly rails against the presence of American troops, especially on the soil of his native Saudi Arabia. So very much the motives of Islamic extremists, you know, in many, many ways mirror our own.
Well, yeah, and their behavior. I mean, they really, if you look at Osama bin Laden and his theory of collateral damage, he seems a lot like the Republicans in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Of course, you've written a book about the American Taliban and the Christian right that really mirror their enemies in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, Karen Armstrong has written about this, I think, very intelligently. I mean, fundamentalists, no matter what their political hue, whether they're Christian or Muslim or Hindu or Jewish, or have far more in common with each other than they do with their co-religionists. Fundamentalism itself is, especially when fundamentalists believe that they can use violence to remove human impediments to a more perfect society, have far more similarities. They in many ways resemble the very people they're trying to destroy.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews and Chris Hedges after these messages.